monthly podcast on the spoken word. Episode number 84, January 2025. Why Animals Talk. A conversation with Arik Kirschenbaum. Hi again, Paul Meyer here. It's the first podcast of 2025. Happy New Year to you all. First, a big thank you to all who donated to IDEA on Giving Tuesday. And if you bought a copy of my Accents and Dialects for Stage and Screen during the holiday sale, thank you for that. The sale continues until January 3rd, so you haven't missed your chance. $10 off through January 3rd, 2025. 27 of the Accents and Dialects actors need most. Get the same discount at paulmeyer.com for the printed version and on your iTunes account, if you prefer an Apple book. And you can still listen to my audiobook reading of Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol until January 3rd, 2025. Go to paulmeyer.com/Christmas Carol, all lowercase, no spaces. This is Dickens' original and uncut text. Now, guess that accent. Last time I played this clip from the IDEA archive and challenged you to say where on the planet the speaker grew up.
We spent a lot of time going to the forest and to the beach and down to the small river. I had a small boat, so I went fishing most of the time. And the homework that I did make, I very often read it down in my boat. We often went to the beach. And generally speaking, I mean, it was another time because we didn't have computers or phones. And we had to, like, use our imagination, I think, more than children do today.
What was your guess? It was IDEA's Denmark 5. For the full recording and all the documentation, go to Accents and Dialects on the menu tab of dialectsarchive.com, then Europe, then Denmark. The sample was contributed by Amaya Viegas. Thanks again, Amaya. In addition to his Danish accent in English, you'll enjoy hearing the speaker read a little of The Ugly Duckling by Hans Christian Andersen in his native Danish. Now, this month's challenge. Where did this speaker spend his formative years?
A gentleman, he is a businessman. He has opened a funeral parlor, became undertaker. But his wish, he is praying for people to die in the area at least 10 a week. So that he's an honest man working. So as you work, if people are dying and they're buying the caskets and those things, and then he can pay his debts.
What's your guess? Get the answer next time. If you aren't listening to me on paulmeyer.com, switch over now. Select In a Manner of Speaking from the Other Services menu tab, then click episode number 84. You'll find lots of details about my guest and other relevant audio and video links, not available on any other podcast channel. And you can subscribe from any page of the website. My guest this month is the distinguished Cambridge zoologist Arik Kirschenbaum, author of the best-selling Zoologist's Guide to the Galaxy, and now his latest book, Why Animals Talk. Welcome, Dr. Kirschenbaum.
Thank you.
This podcast, in a manner of speaking, in our 83 episodes so far, has been confined to human speech, but you remind us very powerfully that animals talk too. But I guess talking is the same as speaking, or is it?
Well, we can get hung up on definitions, of course, but I think talking is a really useful way of describing vocal communication. Speech does seem to imply language a little bit more. So, yeah, let's stick to talking.
So your wonderful book is Why Animals Talk, The New Science of Animal Communication. It's not do animals talk, but why? So, Arik, it's a settled question.
It's an important question. And one of the things that I always like to remind my students when they first arrive is that as zoologists, our primary question is why, not what. People think that zoologists run around collecting butterflies and like organizing them and things like that. But no, we are interested in evolutionary questions. We're interested in why particular animals behave in a particular way or have particular traits or yes. Live in a particular place. It's that evolutionary explanation. How did it come to be? that animals communicate in the way that they do. And this is what really interests me and other animal communication scientists.
Okay. So you sent me 11 audio files of animals talking, not speaking, talking. Can we play one right away? Which one would you like?
Let's start with the wolves, I suppose. Everyone knows wolf howls. Let's go with wolf howls.
So, yeah, you make the point in the book that that's one of the most evocative sounds in the whole animal chorus. Yes. How does that speak to you? How does that wolf howl speak to you? What does it say to you?
It's a really interesting clip because that was recorded very close, very, very close up to the animals themselves. So you can hear a whole range of different kinds of sounds. You can hear the howls, everyone's familiar with the howls, but you also hear all the barking and yipping and squealing and these sort of short range sounds that we might be a bit more familiar with from the sounds that dogs make. But it really does emphasize that this communication, this way of conveying information from one animal to another, is really very diverse. It's very complex. Different kinds of sounds, howls for long range communication, sort of whines and squeaks for short range communication, and they all mean different things. It's a very, very complex communication channel.
Yes. So you write about seven animals in total: the wolf, the dolphin, parrot, hyrax, gibbon, chimpanzee, and human. Why did you choose these seven?
Most of the animals that I've chosen are animals that I've worked with quite a lot in the wild. So I've got a lot of experience being out there in their environment, listening to them, interacting with them. And it was really important for me to place this whole discussion of a particular animal behavior in the context of the world in which they live, in the context of where they live, how they live, who they live with, what's around them, because these are the things that are dictating the kinds of communication that they have. So a lot of the book is anecdotes, a lot of descriptions from being out there in the field with the wolves or the gibbons, and that's the way that you can really feel what it is that's driving a particular kind of communication, why they're communicating in one way and not another way. It's all tied up with their way of life, their social interactions in particular, but also the sort of environment that they live in.
Yes, because they wouldn't be saying the things they say if they lived in another place or under different circumstances, would they? I suppose.
The extreme example, of course, you think about dolphins living underwater. They've got to have a different way of communicating from animals that live on land and are communicating through air. So their immediate environment, it does influence the kinds of sounds they can make. But the most important determining factor in the kinds of communication that an animal has is what its social structure is. Who are the other animals that they need to be communicating with?
The way we think about talking in the first place is pitifully narrow, isn't it? I will never think about talking and speaking in quite the same way after reading your book. For the listeners, please blow their minds as you did for me. How can you expand our thinking about the whole question of animal language?
Well, where I start is with the question that everyone always has is, what are animals saying? Are they talking? Do they have a language? And the point that I make is that it's an inappropriate question because there are so many animals. All of them communicate, all of them, everyone, and
Everyone.
yet they all have different communicative needs. Some communicate more, some communicate less, some talk more, some talk less. So, really, rather than asking ourselves a simple question about, do animals talk? Do animals have a language? We need to ask ourselves about the animals themselves. And when you drill down and you look at, for instance, those animals that have really complex social interactions, wolves, for instance, or dolphins, then you can see that they are using this communication channel to help them navigate their social environment, which shouldn't surprise us. This is what we do. No one is surprised that humans communicate with each other in the groups that we live in. And for some reason, we're surprised that animals do. No, this is an adaptive mechanism. It's like having fur or like having long teeth. This is something that animals that live in societies need to do. They need to communicate with their friends. They need to understand their enemies, just like we do in human societies.
I loved your point that natural selection wouldn't have allowed a species to evolve, squeaking and grunting and howling, all very energy consuming activities, as you point out, if those squeaks and grunts and growls didn't confer evolutionary advantages. Maybe think of all the seemingly pointless energy we burn in conversation as humans. All that small talk must have a purpose, right?
Well, I would argue that the animals have small talk as well. I think small talk does have a purpose. It has a very clear role in both mediating social interactions, but also in terms of understanding social interactions. So when you're having small talk with another individual, you're not in an aggressive or a confrontational mode. So the fact that wolves, for instance, will grunt and yip and make these sort of soft sounds, and in fact, very many animals have these soft contact calls, we call them, these sort of little sounds they make all the time. These have a tremendous social role in letting the other animals know what's going on.
Yes,
is there conflict? Is everything okay? Am I angry? Am I happy? That's the same kind of social interaction that we're quite familiar with as humans.
I remember the moment in the book where you said, well, we as humans, we'll greet a total stranger on the street and we'll say, it turned out nice today. I mean, both parties know that it's a nice day. The sun's shining. It's not raining. But yet we feel obliged or it serves a purpose of some kind to communicate the obvious, right?
It does. And that's an important reminder that we think of communication, we think of information, we think that communication has to be about conveying some kind of complex concepts. Well, it doesn't. Very often, it's about understanding the current state of what's going on, even in very general terms, and expressing emotions in very general terms. These are very important messages, both for animals and for humans as well.
Yeah. I promised my botanist friend, Frank Norman, hi, Frank, to ask you this question. Do you, as a zoologist, have colleagues who think about plant communication the same way you do about animals? I mean, plants aren't vocal, of course, or perhaps there are some plants that are vocal.
Well, it's, in fact, perhaps controversial, but I don't think amongst biologists it would be considered controversial to say plants do communicate. Of course, plants communicate.
Of course they do.
From an evolutionary perspective, communication is simply a way of sending a message that is altering the behavior of another organism.
That's its kind of definition, isn't it?
This is the fundamental evolutionary definition. It's a signal that changes the behavior of another organism, but for your own benefit. It sounds very manipulative, but it's actually the origin of all forms of communication. When you think about a flower being colorful to attract pollinators, this is a form of communication. They're manipulating the behavior of the pollinator to come to this flower and to spread the pollen. And it's clearly for the benefit of the plant. So this is clearly a form of visual communication. We don't think of it in those terms. We often think of communication as being something intentional. Clearly, plants don't have intention. They don't have brains. But intention is not a fundamental part of communication by any means. It's quite possible to communicate without intention.
Yes, you talk about your time with the Vietnamese rangers in the forest and how you got on without a language in common.
Yes, because much of our communication is non-linguistic. I mean, what makes humans humans, what makes us different from all other animals in the world, is that we have this incredible language. This incredible language that can convey so much information, unlimited amount of information, can say anything we want to say. And yet we don't use it all that much. It may seem like we use it a lot, we're using it now, but in many of our communicative interactions with other humans, this is done without language. Hand gestures, with facial expressions, there's so much that we can understand about the state of mind and the state of play of other individuals without language. And that's exactly what animals are doing. They are conveying information, they are getting their message across. You don't need language to do that.
Yeah. Your book privileges sound over sight and other forms of non-vocal communication, like the dances of bees or the smells that so fascinate our dogs. You clearly miss your dog, Darwin, since you dedicate the book to him, right?
Absolutely, yes. Yes, very much so. Nearly 2 years now.
There must be information that the dogs get when they spend endless hours sniffing the ground and sniffing the fire hydrant. I really do wonder what our dogs, what kind of information, or is it just pleasure, or what information is conveyed olfactorily?
It's understood that communication, the sending of signals, is always, from an evolutionary perspective, something that has arisen on the back of sensing. So we speak because we can hear. We communicate with body language because we can see. It's not the other way around. First, organisms evolved a means of sensing and detecting the world, so which they would use to find food or to escape from predators. And then, given that animals could see and smell and hear, then that gave an opening for the evolution of communication, sending signals on those channels. So the fact that dogs communicate using smell is very closely tied to the fact that dogs sense using smell, sense food, sense territory, and so on. So those two are very, very, very closely linked. Now, once you have the ability to smell really well, you have the ability to send messages by smell really well. And that's exactly what happens with scent marking and so on. The reason that I talk so much about sound in my book, rather than sight and smell and other senses, is that sound has some very, very, very special properties that has led it to become the preeminent communicative medium among animals on planet Earth. That is that sound goes around things.
Yes.
Light does not go around things. Now, smell also goes around things, but smell is very, very slow. Smell travels extremely slowly in air, and it gets mixed up, and it's difficult to send complex messages by smell. Sound is really the only way that you can communicate long distance in a reasonable time in a forest or around trees or around mountains and things like that. Sound just has those properties that makes it the ideal medium for complex communication.
Yes. Let's listen to another of your sound clips. Can you pick one?
How about the gibbons?
I'm hearing two very different tones in there. Is that what you're hearing?
What you're hearing there is extremely, extremely rare animal called the Calvert gibbon. There are only 70 of these animals left in the world in one tiny patch of jungle. At the beginning, what you're hearing, the repeated call is the male calling. That incredible crescendo at the end is the female response. They live in small family groups with a bonded male-female pair, and they're calling to one another. It's primarily communication between the male and the female. Although, of course, it's also marking their territory. It's also announcing to other gibbon groups in the area that this is the territory that belongs to this particular family group. You can just hear from that how well this sound penetrates the jungle, how well this sound travels through the trees and can be heard for miles and miles around. And it's incredibly haunting, incredibly beautiful, and
Isn't
incredibly coordinated as well. So sometimes the songs can become really quite complex and quite complex interactions between the individuals, which illustrate what? Do we know? Not really.
it?
Don't exactly know why these songs are quite so complex. We can certainly compare it to birdsong. We're all familiar with complex birdsong. And one of the reasons that birds sing complex songs is that they are demonstrating their prowess. So the male will sing a complex song to attract females or scare other males away. And we think probably something similar is going on, demonstrating to other gibbons in the area just what a strong group this particular group of gibbons is to defend their territory.
I was wondering, with their shrinking numbers, whether their linguistic repertoire is also shrinking.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really important question, and it's an important question for many, many, many endangered species. You do tend to see a loss of communicative repertoire. You have a small number of individuals. Perhaps they have less opportunity to learn the different ways of singing from many animals surrounding them, or they get stuck in one particular way of communicating because that's all they ever hear. It is an issue that the diversity of behavior will tend to drop with the diversity of a population, even with the genetic diversity of a population. So you see the two go hand in hand. They're both a form of really serious threat to the survival of endangered species, the loss of genetic diversity, but also the loss of behavioral diversity as well.
Sobering. In your chapter on wolves, the first chapter, you emphasize that their howling is a long distance communication, even though, as you proved earlier, they have this close up, intimate way of speaking as well. Reminded me of my podcast I did on whistled human speech with Julian Mayer, episode number 60. Whistled human speech, as you probably know, is specifically for talking at a distance, sometimes over a mile or two, in the deep canyons and ravines of the Canary Islands, for example. Yeah, it's important to distinguish between the long distance benefits and the short distance, the intimate repertoire.
In the most simplistic way, they're very, very similar. In fact, these whistling languages and wolf howls, and actually dolphin whistles as well, share some certain features in common. When we're speaking now, much of the information in our voices is carried in various kinds of amplitude modulation, the changes in the volume of the different parts of our speech elements, changes in the precise composition of the sounds that we make and which harmonics are present and which ones are absent. That's one of the things that makes human speech very complex and capable of expressing a lot of different ideas with a lot of different sounds. But that information, that kind of amplitude modulated information, is almost entirely lost at a distance. If you try and listen to someone speaking from far away, you will not be able to understand them, even if you can hear them. Because all of that really complex information is attenuated very, very quickly at distance. The kinds of things that are well preserved at distance are frequency modulated sounds, a whistle that goes up and down, or a single tone that goes up and down. And those are very easily perceived at distance. Now, this is precisely why wolves howl. This is precisely why wolves howl up and down in pitch. And it's precisely why humans use whistling language or yodeling languages to communicate over long distances. The same is true for dolphin whistles.
You reminded me that the sounds emitted by a species that have very small territory tend to not be as loud as those like wolves that have a large territory.
Yes, and when you're a songbird and you're defending a territory that might only be a few trees, then you can invest an awful lot in forming a very complex song that doesn't necessarily carry very far. Whereas if you really do want to convey your territorial message over a long distance, your song must necessarily be less complex. There is a trade-off between complexity and that long-range fidelity.
Interesting. I'm going to go to the very core of this for me, the very heart of the question. You're very careful to avoid ascribing meaning, as we would do in human language, to a particular animal utterance. Even though it's clear that the noise is loaded with information, can it ever have a one-to-one correspondence with meaning? I mean, the noises, Meyer, Kirschenbaum, specific set of noises that we call words. And those noises have very specific meaning. When, if it does that happen in the animal kingdom?
Animal sounds do, of course, have meaning. Well, I say, of course, one could argue that they don't, but I think it's fairly clear that they do have meaning in the sense of information that, as I mentioned before, changes the behavior of another animal. So another animal will hear these sounds and will somehow interpret them in some way and change their behavior. And this is why communication evolves. So if there were no meaning in that sense, there would be no communication at all. What there isn't is the kind of semantic meaning that you're referring to, where a particular utterance corresponds to one particular meaning. Now, of course, even in human language, that's not quite true. There are many different sounds that don't have a single meaning, or that have multiple meanings, or have a fairly vague meaning. So it's not entirely true that humans are semantically one-to-one and animals are not. But it's certainly true that humans have that property of having this repertoire of signals that have a single meaning, whereas animals almost never do. few examples, a very small number of examples of animals with a particular sound that has a particular meaning. Almost always, these are alarm calls. There's a tiger, there's an eagle. Those sorts of things can benefit from evolutionarily from having a single meaning. But most of all, what animals need to communicate, it's much vaguer than that. We don't need to say exactly how to connect resistors and capacitors to make a radio or something. They don't need that information. What they need to know is, are you being friendly? Are you happy? Are you hungry? Is everything okay? Where's the danger coming from? These are the kinds of messages that need to be conveyed. And so the communication channel can be much less specific.
I loved your point that while wolves howl for clearly specific reasons, that they sometimes do it, seem to do it just for fun and with little apparent point, just because they like it. Again, is that like human small talk?
I don't think it's surprising at all that wolves enjoy howling and howl for the enjoyment of it. Because when you consider that howling has a number of roles, but one of the roles is territorial, to defend, to advertise your territory against intruders. One is to keep in touch with other wolves in your pack because they tend to disperse quite widely, so you need to know where everyone is. So when everyone is together, when everyone is safe, it's a good feeling for the animals. And they just howl because it's a reaffirmation that their social group is here all together and howling together. It's important to come back to these evolutionary drivers. Wolves need to be in groups to survive. So this idea of creating a cohesive, strong social group where individual wolves cooperate with each other, this has clear evolutionary benefits. So howling as a means of forming that social cohesion is something that you can really see evolving, giving an advantage and continuing to evolve.
And you've studied wolves in the wild in Yellowstone and in Wisconsin, and
Yes,
perhaps and northern Italy too, I imagine.
and Spain and Israel and a few other places in the world. Yes, they're very, very widespread species and really very different, and very different in their howling behavior as well across the world. Very, very different. You can imagine that in the Arctic, where the animals have to travel much further to forage for foods, for instance, there'll be a very different kind of long-range communication than in Europe, where territories are very much smaller. Animals seldom travel more than a few kilometers from each other. There's really a very different need for different kinds of howling.
Makes sense. As a dialect coach, my ears pricked up when I saw wolf dialects. Tell us the story of your research in northern Italy where the wolves pretend to be sheepdogs.
We've known for a while that different wolf subspecies or different wolf populations have very different howls, and you can actually tell quite easily what kind of wolf it is in many cases. Wonderful story of a colleague of mine who extremely annoyed when watching a vampire movie set in Transylvania and the wolves howling on this movie. Got up and said, "Oh, those are clearly North American wolves." And it is quite easy to tell the difference between North American and European wolves. The point is that because of the flexibility of this signal, there's a signal where all you have to do is move the pitch of your howl up and down. And precisely how you move it up and down can vary tremendously. And that is under the control of the animals themselves. So here was a situation in Europe, where we have livestock guardian dogs, so sheepdogs are protecting the flocks, and wolves living around the farms, and dogs are howling, and the wolves are howling. And remarkably, the wolves howling much more like the sheepdogs than would be expected. European wolves generally have a very flat howl. They tend to very constant pitch. They don't go up and down very much in their pitch. Dogs are much more variable in their pitch. And here are these wolves, and they're almost copying the sheepdogs. Why are they doing that? Is this because they want to deceive the sheepdogs or deceive the farmers? It's an intriguing thought. It's possible. There's clearly an adaptive advantage to not being detected. Better that the farmers don't know that there are wolves there. But it could just be simply a case of copying. It could just be the case that animals that are living nearby, that are making similar signals, will tend to converge on a similar kind of way of communicating. They are, after all, learning from each other in a way. So there are many possibilities there. There are so many questions about animal communication that you would have thought we understand a lot about, that really we're only just starting to investigate.
The movie got the dialect of the wolf wrong in the Transylvania setting.
These European wolves do tend to howl very flat. North American wolves modulate their pitch much more. So it is quite striking. And now, is this because that modulated howl is more effective in North America than it is in Europe? Or is it just a sort of random drift that has led these dialects to drift apart, just as human dialects drift apart, human accents drift apart, even if there's no actual reason for them being different? We don't know the answer to that.
Yes, I'm flashing on the evolution of American English from the British English of the early colonists. 1600, you wouldn't have been able to tell the Brits and the Yanks apart. Interesting. Yeah. A complete non sequitur there. Let's talk about dolphins. You say they have the largest collection of word-like noises in the animal kingdom. Am I getting that right?
Dolphins have a very unusual ability, which is to give themselves names. So, as I said, mostly if you're looking for a one-to-one semantic representation, you find that almost exclusively in alarm calls, and maybe a handful of different alarm calls for different types of predators in certain primates, for instance. But what dolphins do is that they have the ability to give themselves vocal names.
Signature sounds. This is me. This is me. This is Maya. This is
Exactly.
Kirschenbaum. Okay.
Exactly. And that's really pretty exceptional.
Before I go any further, let's play a dolphin noise. What are you hearing there?
Well, when you reach my age, it gets a little bit difficult to hear some of the dolphin whistles at full speed because they are quite high pitched.
Yes.
So you slow them down, then it becomes much more clear. And actually, if you slow them down, if you slow them down enough, about 30 times, they sound remarkably like wolf howls. So the really dolphin whistles are just speeded up wolf howls. So what you're hearing there is the sort of rise and fall in the pitch that is very characteristic. Each one is different, characteristic of the particular animal. As a young dolphin matures, it develops its own signature whistle, its own sound that represents itself.
It's idiolect, perhaps.
Perhaps. Yeah, obviously reluctant to draw too many comparisons, and particularly, it's difficult to draw too much interpretation of how the animal actually perceives this. Now,
Yes.
we know, for instance, that in the wild, dolphins use about 30% of their calls are signature whistles, but the remaining 70% is a huge diversity of other kinds of whistles of different sorts, of non-stereotyped, sometimes this kind, sometimes that kind. So it's really, really tempting to say, well, if the dolphins recognize each other's signature whistles, then surely those other 70% of whistles also have meanings. And it's quite a dangerous assumption to make, but it's a very intriguing one. And it's a very reasonable hypothesis. But try as we may, we have not managed to figure out whether those non-signature whistles also have semantic meaning in the same way that the signature whistles do. It's very tempting, particularly with dolphins. There's so much sort of mythology around dolphin
Yes.
communication and dolphin intelligence. It's very tempting to assume that this complexity of the repertoire reflects a complexity of the information that's contained in these signals. But it's extremely difficult to investigate these things, extremely difficult to test.
And of course, the pitfall is to make assumptions or conjectures based on our own species. Your book challenges us to avoid human centrism when it comes to thinking and talking about language and communication. So help me a little further and my listeners to become a little less human centric when we're thinking about language.
We're really used to the power of language. The power of language is tremendous. It has helped the human race to achieve everything that we've achieved, for good and for bad. And so it's tempting to think that every animal would benefit from having language. Partly that leads us to think we are better because we have language and other animals don't. But it also leads us to wonder, why don't other animals have language like we do? And it leads us to scenarios like, I suppose, the sort of Planet of the Apes scenario. It's like, if you left the animals for long enough, if you left apes alone on the world for long enough, they would evolve their own language. And these are all fallacies. Every animal on Earth, from the jellyfish to the dolphins, has been evolving for exactly the same 4 billion years that we have. We're nowhere ahead of any other animal. We are simply occupying a niche, a very particular niche, where language is really beneficial. For other animals, it isn't. Otherwise, they'd have language. Animals have evolved exactly the level of communication that is suitable for the life that they lead. They don't need language. It's actually quite disadvantageous in many ways to have language. One of the reasons that we go through such traumatic childbirth are huge brains. This is one of the costs we pay, one of the trade-offs that we have to accept for having language. Why do we do this? Maybe the animals are laughing at us, like, look at these humans. They've all got it. They're wasting their time with this language. We're getting on just fine. And that's really true. Dolphins don't need language. Wolves don't need language, and so they don't have it. Rather than looking at language as being sort of pinnacle of evolution, it's just another trait, just like having fur or, swimming fast through the water. It's a something that gives us abilities in the niche that we occupy that other animals simply don't need.
That's the most brilliant exposition of how to become less human-centric. Thank you so much. That's great. Let's talk about at least one more of the species covered in your book. Can I play a sound clip first? Should we choose one more species?
Sure, go for the Hyrax.
Don't think I'd ever heard of what a hyrax is. So let's first of all hear hyrax, and then you can tell us all about them. So what's a hyrax?
Hyraxes are small, furry mammals. They live in southern and East Africa and the Middle East, and they make an awful lot of noise. And these very complex sounds as well. We're pretty sure they're not saying very much. In fact, almost positive that all they're saying is a male advertising his territory and his prowess, as it were. So in many ways, hyrax song is very much equivalent to male bird song. It's just saying, this is me. If you're a male, stay away. If you're a female, come here. In that sense, they wouldn't be particularly interesting. But what's incredible about hyraxes, what makes them especially interesting, is that the syntax of these songs is remarkably complex. Even more interesting than the complexity of the syntax is that they learn the syntax from each other. So if you listen to hyraxes that live nearby, they will tend to copy the syntax of each other. In other words, the way that those different notes are combined to make those songs will end up being similar. Now, this is surprising. This is very surprising because we tend to think of syntax and grammar as being something inherently linked to language. But in fact, syntax, understanding of syntax, the ability to use syntax, is extremely widespread amongst animals. Birds being an excellent example, but even hyraxes, these very simple animals that really are not saying anything other than, here I am, this is me, they're using these complex syntaxes.
It's melodically complex and infinitely variable
It's
and
combinatorial.
improvised, and it's like jazz. Are they riffing? What's going on?
It's combinatorically complex. In other words, the way that they decide which note to use following another note is not random and is consistent. So they have a consistent sort of strategy for how they combine these notes together. And this tells us something very, very important, which is that syntax, which is an absolute foundation of human language, isn't actually something very special. It's something that's very widespread across the animal kingdom. We didn't invent syntax when we invented language, when we evolved language. All of these fundamental abilities, the ingredients that were needed for our ancestors to evolve the kind of complex communication that they did, were already present. The ability to combine sounds in different ways, the meanings, they were all there. And our ancestors just put them together and used them to convey particularly more complex ideas. And I just find it endlessly amazing that such an animal as the Hyrax has this complex learned syntax. Their brains understand exactly what that syntax is.
That's amazing. I can understand your passion and you're devoting your career to this topic. Yeah. It's unthinkable that you could have avoided a chapter on humans. Why is it the last chapter in the book, not the first?
The chapter on humans is more about showing that sort of last step, that last point that I made, that our ancestors brought all these different elements together. What parrots do, and what hyraxes do, what wolves do, all of these different elements of communication are present in many different animals. And somehow our ancestors evolved to combine them all together to have a true language. And I mean, the other reason that humans are the last chapter of the book is that so many people are interested in this question, do animals have language? I really kind of wanted to get away from that question because I want people to understand the animals for what they are, not as a comparison to humans.
Yes.
Animal communication is interesting because it's communication, not because it's not language. And yet, I couldn't finish the book without talking about language and without talking about what language is, and essentially leaving the readers to decide, do they think that animals have this thing that humans have? Now that we know why animals talk and how they communicate, what they need to say and why they need to say it, and this is what language is, what do you think? Do you think they have it or not? And that's, this is something that the reader has to form their own opinion.
Arik, I wish there was time to engage you in your speculation about communicating with extraterrestrials, but perhaps you'd come back for a second visit on that someday.
Absolutely. That's another fascinating topic.
Just as a tease, give us a minute or so on it, communicating with extraterrestrials before we say goodbye.
This is another thing that I sort of work on as a sideline, asking questions like, if we were to send a message to extraterrestrials, how would you do it in a way that was universally intelligible? This cuts really to this question of where does language come from? Because any extraterrestrial civilization, and I'm talking about a civilization with technology and spaceships and radios and things like that, any extraterrestrial civilization evolved from a non-technological species. It's just how evolution works. Nothing popped into existence. So the language, the communication of these hypothetical extraterrestrials will be based on, will have evolved from animal communication of their ancestors. So, in many ways, looking at how human language evolved from the communication of our ancestors and their nearest relatives is one of the only ways we can really think about what might a really unusual, unanticipated, out of the box alien language look like. Well, pretty much the only thing we've got to say is that it evolved from non-language.
That's wonderful. That's a nice tease. I look forward perhaps to visiting with you on that topic in more depth. Thank you, Arik Kirschenbaum, for talking to me today. Congratulations on the success of Why Animals Talk and Happy New Year.
Thank you very much.
And thanks to you for joining me, Paul Meyer, and my guest, Arik Kirschenbaum. For full information about him and his publications and media appearances, go to paulmeyer.com, choose In a Manner of Speaking from the Other Services tab on the menu bar, and click episode number 84. Don't forget to follow Paul Meyer Dialect Services on Facebook and me on X or Twitter at DialectPaul. Email me with your comments and questions, paul@paulmeyer.com. The audio clips in this episode were all used by permission or taken from YouTube and used under the copyright doctrine of fair use. Next month, my guest is Spencer Lott, a very appropriate guest to follow Professor Kirschenbaum, since he works with talking animals too, at least in puppet form. He's the celebrated puppeteer of Sesame Street fame. He gives voice to many of our beloved Muppet characters, human and non-human, Tune in again next time to In a Manner of Speaking.